Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We have Thomas Laird. Today it is the Thomas Laird Show. Bill Russell and I are with Thomas Laird.
We're sitting at his feet.
Yes, honoring the incarnation of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet. This vast and mysterious notion has real use, forgive the utilitarian nature of my saying that, particularly in the United States, but I think in the industrialized world, not to be confused with developed world, because in some ways the East is more developed when you talk about Buddhism and the ideas that are ancient and very practical. In the industrialized world, it is very easy to just blow off vast and mysterious, and yet that doesn't mean it goes away.
No.
And I kind of had that feeling as you allow us in the course of writing this story to watch you kind of exhale and open yourself to a different way of being. Did you have that sense of being more welcoming of and inclusive within the mysterious?
You know,
pretty hard-headed kind of guy.
By the time I met His Holiness, I had been in Asia for 30 years, and I converted to Buddhism when I was 19. So I'd been deeply involved with Buddhism for 30 years by the time I met him, 25 years by the time I met him. And I was sort of sick of Westerners who jump into Buddhism and then want to go and talk to the Dalai Lama about, well, I was Napoleon in my last life sort of stuff, you know, or they want the secret teachings today. Thank you so much. You know, and I had almost, I was tired of that. In fact, my deeply Buddhist friends in Kathmandu, when they heard that the Dalai Lama had agreed to do this book with me, they were like, Tom Laird? He's doing this with Tom Laird?
Why did you do it with me? Because I want to know about Napoleon.
Well, because, no, they were, many people are much more Buddhist and than I am.
And in fact, you never give that away. I would not have known that. And you not said it just this moment. You are always the skeptical Westerner
in
persona.
This, because I had this deep background in Buddhism by the time I came to him, but I had already become a bad Buddhist. So that by the time I approached him, I knew the history. I knew a lot about the history of Tibet when we went into this, and I knew that Buddhism in Tibet had its flaws, just as every religion does. And so it wasn't, I didn't come in there with rose-tinted glasses, as so many people approach His Holiness. So it was a wonderful chance to, I went in there skeptically, and by approaching him skeptically and challenging him and bringing facts, books, quoting him things, bringing that to the table in the conversation, it gave him the chance to defend his position. And we learned so much more by an open dialogue than by some, you know, hagiography of the saint.
In addition to which, that is his tradition, this
yes.
dialogue debate tradition. And most people simply don't know, how does a Buddhist monk become a Buddhist monk, Tom
Through
Laird?
Dialogue.
But it's not just sitting down having coffee.
No. It's violent debate where people are standing up, clapping their hands, and really going at one another and citing texts and saying, wait a minute, you've said this, but here, look, read this text. And that's exactly what we did. And it was very, and I would not have been able to challenge him if he had not allowed it. And in fact, he did more than allow it. He encouraged it from the get-go.
It is something to read this book and watch you challenging, as most of us say, but it's the Dalai Lama. but.
And it was wonderful to be able to go and, I mean, there's the spiritual level of this book, but there's also the political level.
And you are always respectful. I don't mean
yes,
that in any way
absolutely.
To sound inappropriate.
No, no.
It is always a learning experience.
No,
not
His Holiness appreciated, I mean, from the beginning, he said to me, you know, you this has to be the truth. And I said, well, you know, sometime if I'm bringing things in here, I'm going to contradict you. And he said, yes, good. And so I took him at his word, you know.
Which is not what you would get from the number one guy, as in a pope,
no.
from most religious traditions,
no.
where there is a theology that has to be defended. And that isn't
well,
what you experienced, is it?
No.
The absence of dogma,
yes.
are the, I won't say absence, but the, how to say, very low level of it.
It's one of the defining aspects.
With
of
respect to this book, but also with respect to His Holiness. I mean, he has taken certain dogma and thrown it out because the evidence
isn't there
that something that they had believed for 1,000 years turns out not to be the case. Oh, well, we were wrong.
Oh, blah, move on.
And that goes to the Buddha. By his telling
the historical Buddha.
Historical Buddha, that you know, when everything's said and done, one of the things, and you make this wonderfully clear, and your conversation is exemplary of this. Buddha not only allows you, he requires that you test and go to the evidence.
Yeah, he gives you a shovel. It's not faith to believe. It's not like, look at this shovel and believe in it. It's take this shovel and use it.
And it is forgotten in the Western tradition that is what a 12-year-old Jesus of Nazareth did when he went to the temple and argued with the rabbis.
Absolutely.
And in the Jewish tradition, you argue with God, not only the rabbis. And this give and take has got, particularly within very fundamentalist circles of any religion, you don't have that. It's a closed system intentionally. But when you have this openness to exploration, to debate, to dialogue, which for those who have followed the Christian tradition is exemplified by Jesus of Nazareth in opening things up and looking at them and figuring out how best to proceed.
Mm-hmm. And there is a serious iconoclastic quality to that. And again, it shows up in your conversations.
The way the Dalai Lama reveals his nature through this discussion of history, his own personal nature, is one of the most striking things about this book. In many ways, this book becomes a biography of His Holiness as well as a history of Tibet, because by studying history of Tibet with him, he reveals who he is, what he wants, what his real desires are, what he thinks of his place in the world, in a way that if we went and asked him, please tell me about the Mahatantra, most of us wouldn't know and understand the Mahatantra teachings.
He also reveals his own sense of his weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
his
always
fears,
willing
his anger,
to blame himself first.
Not willing. That's the rule. Take responsibility. It's an amazing thing with him to hear him taking responsibility for the it's like, okay, China invaded Tibet. Well, he says, if we had built an army, if Tibet hadn't been so obsessed with religion, if we had had more, widespread, if we'd had more of a democratic society, that wouldn't have been possible. He blames Tibet.
It is interesting to hear His Holiness the Dalai Lama, a Buddhist, which has an essential foundation, not the entire foundation, in nonviolence, talking about, gee, if we just had an army, there seems to be a contradiction there.
Mm-hmm. Not really. If you understand Tibetan Buddhism is Mahayana, not Hinayana. And of course, one of the primary teachings, one of the big things that differentiates Mahayana, the great school of Buddhism, from Hinayana, the lesser school of Buddhism. And you know who gave those two definitions, of course.
The lesser vehicle.
Yes. That was the Mahayana. The Theravadins are called.
To the victor goes the naming.
Yes. And so, at any rate, for Mahayanas, one of the things is that there may be a moment, for a Mahayana Buddhist, there could be a moment when the most Buddhist thing to do would be to kill someone. Now, for Hinayana or Theravadin Buddhists, there is no killing of anything. That's according to them, the Buddha taught that you can never kill anything. That's a complete violation of Buddha's teachings. However, the Mahayanas say that Buddha gave a secret teaching to a few disciples, an inner teaching, not for the masses, but for those with more further study. And at that level of the game, when you say, the great example is, in Tibetan history, there was a king who had killed, who had tried to destroy Buddhism in Tibet, and he had closed the monasteries, and he had had many monks killed, and he had forced many monks to murder animals so that they would lose their vows. And so Buddhism was being destroyed in Tibet in the 9th century, and at the time of Lang Dharma. And according to Tibetan mythology and about this history, at one point a monk comes forward, Lalung Palge Dorji, and he dances up towards the king wearing the robes of a Bonpo priest, a non-Buddhist priest. And deep within his robes, he's hidden this bow and arrow. He pulls out the bow and arrow and he shoots Lang Dharma between the eyes and kills him. And then he jumps onto a black horse and rides through a river. And the black horse, the coal dust washes off the horse and it becomes white, and he reverses his robes, which were black and now they're white, and he drives away. He rides away, and people looking for him are looking for a black man on a black horse, and of course it's a white man on a white horse, so they can't find him. And for me, that's always been a metaphor of the idea that his motivation was to save Buddhism. So the going through the river of motivation, the river of karma, you know, what was his motivation? He was washed by his motivation is the metaphor I've always seen there. And His Holiness confirmed that indeed this is one of the great classic metaphors for Mahayana Buddhists, that there may come a time, you're going to suffer the karma of that murderous action. That's unavoidable in that worldview. But if you then spend the rest of your life meditating, you know, the period that you spend in hell may only be a few years or a few centuries before you reincarnate as a human and then become fully enlightened. So that depending upon your karma, so when I heard this story, I said, so does that mean then if I could have killed Hitler before he started killing millions of people, that would have been a good Buddhist thing to do? And he says, well, depending on your motivation, yes. If you did that out of anger, if you did that to make money, if you did that out of fear, no. But if you did that to save millions of lives, knowing that you would suffer, knowing that you would go to hell, to a Buddhist hell, which is not eternal, then that could be, yes, that could be a Buddhist thing to do. At the same time, he immediately says, now, you know, we don't normally talk about this too much because there's a tendency people just want to say, oh, well, then I'll just kill anybody. And you can't. You have to really apply discriminating wisdom to this. You can't just use this casually. But it is one of the differences between Tibetan Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism.
And when we come back, Bill Russell, who is ready to continue the conversation, will do so in a moment. Please return with us.